All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Kabbalah and Coffee. It's great to see everybody here this morning. Okay, so today we talk about a few incredible topics, including we talk about dams, you know, like the river type of dam situation. We talk about forehead and faces and testimony and ID and Jewish law and, of course, Kabbalah. So that's just a sampling of only a few of the things we'll talk about. And hopefully by the end of this class, everything will make sense and be woven together in a nice package. We begin with a dam. So, and I'm not an expert in rivers and streams and dams and all that stuff. But here's what I think. Sometimes, when you want to increase the flow or the power of water that's flowing, there's two ways to do it. You can either increase the amount of water that's going through. You can add more water somehow, whatever that means. You know, open up other channels of water and add more water to the flow. Or, conversely, you can try to block the water. Sometimes when you block the water, when you put an obstruction in the way of the water, what that does is it the water kind of builds up against the obstruction until the water pressure builds up so much that it knocks away the obstruction and carries everything down the stream or down the river. So what's a good example of this? I mean, this is an example, but I'm trying to think if there's another related. Yeah, but so I don't know. I mean, hopefully when you have a dam, the water doesn't eventually like bust the whole thing open and carry the, you know, all of that material down the river. But I think, you know, you have
high blood pressure.
Right.
As you get more arterial constriction, you get a higher pressure, and eventually you may break a plaque and get a stroke.
There you go. So that's the medical that's a medical correlation here. I'm thinking in the context of, again, getting back to water, you also have this idea of like whitewater rafting. Anybody ever been whitewater rafting? Okay, so whitewater rafting, so there's a lot of rapids and a lot of energy, and typically it's around rocks, right? That's what makes the rapids. When you have some sort of obstruction, that kind of builds the pressure, it creates like a frenzy, like a frenetic energy within the water. Why? Not because you added water to get more power in the water, but because you did something or you attempted to do something to counteract the water, to stop the water, to block the water, like a rock or a few rocks, that creates a lot of energy, a lot of power, a lot of force. Okay, so whether it's the high blood pressure, whether it's the water and the dam or the rock and the rapids, it's the same idea, and that is that to increase something, sometimes you increase in its own power. Sometimes you can increase it by trying to block it. So Kabbalah teaches that one of the ways to open up the soul is paradoxically to block the soul. In other words, one way, a straightforward, if we were speaking in very straightforward terms, or if we were thinking about this in a very, you know, ideal way, we would say, how do you increase the power of your soul, the connection of your soul? It's by doing more soulful things. The more you feed your soul, the more you allow your soul to do, you know, the right thing, good things, noble things, spiritual things, meditation and prayer and charity and mitzvot and studying Torah, all of these things, that leads to greater soul power, greater soul expression. However, there's another path, and that is through soul obstruction, you actually create greater soul power and soul energy. So again, this is a bit paradoxical because, you know, how does the obstruction bring out the soul? And yet we all know that this is true. A simple example. When do we see people banding together with Jewish pride all too often? When do people band together? Communities of Jews. What else? What's a negative example? Bad times, or when there's, let's say, an anti-Semitic incident. Something happens, right? God forbid there's some sort of terrorist attack or anti-Semitic message scrawled on on some sort of Jewish community building or whatever. I mean, God forbid, right? But we know that this, or when these threats were being phoned in recently to JCCs, and what it turns out it was this, whatever. That's its own mess, right? But that brought together, there was a meeting here in Atlanta. I think a few hundred people went to it. Different organizations with representatives about how to combat. This is before they realized it was an Israeli kid that was calling it in. But how to but that guy did it. Like a few of them, this kid did most of them, including Atlanta. I think there's some issues over there. Yeah, it's coming from a place. Yeah. And unfortunately. But anyway, but it brought together, in a sense, it brought together the community. Even here in Atlanta, there was a big meeting, different organizations. Now, you know, they say two Jews, three opinions. Two Jewish organizations, a lot of different opinions. And not always do different organizations work together, which we should, they should, we should, etc. Nonetheless, in response to the anti-Semitism, or again, you know, what was going on, the threats are being phoned in, suddenly you have hundreds of people, representatives of different organizations around Atlanta, getting together discussing what to do about this problem. Now, I'm not saying they came up to a single solution. They didn't. You know, each one had their own take on it, and that's part of the diversity of opinion. But the bottom line is, sometimes it's the obstruction to something that brings out the energy. It's when you back, and this is a theme that we've talked about many times in many different ways, when you back someone into a corner and you tell them, you can't do this, there's nothing that will evoke a desire to do it than that. You tell someone, you can't. Oh, really? I really want to. Right? There's nothing. It's like God says to Adam and Eve, whatever you do, don't eat from this tree. They're like, great. That's the only thing we can think about now. That's the only thing that we want to do is now eat from that tree that you're telling me I can't eat from. Yeah, I have a million trees to eat from, but you tell me not to look at, not to eat it. God didn't say not to look at. I'm adding this on. But you tell me, like, not to eat from that tree, suddenly, why? Wait a second. Now I really want to eat from that tree. Don't tell me no, not to eat from the tree. Now we know, of course, there was the serpent, and it was more complicated than that. But human psychology is such that evokes a sense of desire, the opposite of desire almost, or that which tries to block desire, by contrast, increases that very desire that is being sought to disrupt. Does that make sense? So it's been said. It's been said. And by the way, this is not just modern philosophers and historians that have said this, although they also have said this. But it's said in also ancient text that one of the things that have kept the Jewish people together and kept them strong is anti-Semitism. It says in the Midrash, that Pharaoh, I forget the terminology. Obviously, it's not written in English, but I don't want to misportray it. I don't want to misconstrue it. It says something along the lines of, be careful how I say this. I don't know if Pharaoh did a favor to the Jewish people or he did something positive. In other words, the persecution itself, trying to destroy, trying to harm the Jewish people, that itself turned out to be a blessing. Now, it doesn't mean that we say, thank you, Pharaoh. We, you know, give him a handshake. Thank you. We really appreciate your efforts on behalf of the Jewish people. Obviously not. At the same time, though, the Midrash, and there are other sources as well that talk about like what Haman did, trying to kill the Jewish people with that decree in the times of the story of Purim, and that brought the entire Jewish nation together, and they were unified in one. So there are definitely sources within classic Jewish literature that speak about the upside of that which is trying to block Jewish expression. So, along these lines is what we covered last time, which is a number of weeks ago, a few weeks ago. So we're trying to get back into this text. So we talked about previously in the end of chapter 2. Today we're going to start chapter 4. At the end of chapter 2, he spoke about two types of love, loving God. One type of love is a rational rational, reasonable love. You love God because God gives you everything that you have. God is your life. What do I mean, is your life? God gives you life. So you love life. You love waking up in the morning and being alive. Where does that come from? That comes from God. God is the battery pack that powers you and everything that you love. So therefore, love God, love the battery pack. That's a very basic way of understanding it, right? Love God, love a battery, love the battery pack. That's like our bumper sticker so far for this morning, right? So that's a basic level of understanding it. And I think that even though I'm making it very simple, I think for a lot of people, this is what a relationship with God comes down to. In other words, God gives me this, gives me that, gives me the other. Therefore, I love God, I'll pray to God. You know, stuff doesn't work out, I complain to God. In other words, the relationship is based on what I'm getting. And so it's like a reciprocal type relationship, but more than that, it's based on the perceived goodness or what I get from God and this relationship. On a very basic level, that's one approach to relationship with God. On a deeper level, there is loving God not because of what you get out of the relationship, which, by the way, is not selfish. It's natural. I mean, we all have relationships with people, and part of what makes us enjoy these relationships is what we get out of them. And that's normal, that's natural, and it's the same. We have the same construct. It's paralleled in our relationship with God. And that's okay. Then there's a deeper level that without Kabbalah, it would almost be impossible to even, you know, to conceive, to get to really conceptualize. And what is this deeper dimension? It's loving God, not because of what you get out of it, but loving God to the extent that you're ready to surrender your very identity to be in that relationship. It's a relation, it's a connection, it's a desire, it's not even a connection. It's a desire for God that transcends every reasonable consideration. It's not like I want a closeness with God because then God will hook me up with A, B, and C. Or because God is worthy of having a relationship with because God is so incredible and I want to be connected with something more grand and more magnificent. This is more than that. This is I'm ready to lose myself within something greater than myself. I'm ready to dissolve my very existence within a light much greater than myself. And I know I'm mixing metaphors because dissolve is liquid and light is light, but it doesn't matter. It means I'm ready to surrender my entire being, not because of what I get out of it, but because of the truth of God's existence and the core connection that I have on a soul level. This is called, and this term is going to come back again in chapter 4, this term is going to come up continuously. So it's worth noting this term. It's called Re'uta Deliba, which is an Aramaic term. So Re'uta Deliba. Now, the second word, Deliba, is related to the word Lev. Lev means heart. So Re'uta Deliba, Deliba means of the heart. The second word means of the heart. But what is Re'uta? Re'uta means desire. It's the Aramaic word for desire, but not just any desire, a powerful desire that takes over your entire being. It's like you're drawn, you're driven with such a powerful desire that's all you can think about, that's all you know. It's almost, I would say, obsession, but obsession has a selfish connotation. It's like I'm obsessed with getting something. Typically, that's what obsession is. This is an obsession with connecting completely and purely with God, even to the extent that it might mean to leave one's own space and to leave one's own self. Not that it should come to that, but I'm saying even if that's what it means. This is where, by the way, as we've talked about many times, the capacity of self-sacrifice comes from. The idea of giving one's life for the sanctification of God's name, this is where it comes from. It's not something that we typically look for, but in a certain context, when it had, you know, the story of Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest Torah teachers of all time, Rabbi Akiva, who was caught by the Romans, and he was one of the 10 martyrs that were killed for, you know, their religious activities, their Jewish activities. So as they were killing him, as they were murdering him, torturing him, he was smiling. And his students asked him, "Why are you smiling?" And he said, no, I'm sorry, he wasn't smiling. That's a different story. He was smiling about something else, about the destruction of the temple, which he also got questioned, "Why are you smiling at the destruction of the temple?" And he had a good answer for that. He wasn't smiling. He was saying the Shema. That's what he was doing. He was saying the Shema as he was being tortured to death. The Shema, the ultimate Jewish prayer that talks about God's oneness. And so his students said, I don't know why his students were there. They were tortured. I don't know exactly. It's hard for me to picture exactly how all this went down. But his students were around. And so his students asked him, "What are you doing? Like, how can you say Shema at this moment?" He says to them, "All my life, when I've said the Shema, I've had in mind that I'm willing to give up my life for the sake of God." Talks about God being one, being really everything. And so I was thinking, you know, when will I have the chance to really dedicate myself and give my life up for God? Now that I have the opportunity, I shouldn't say the Shema. He ends it with like a rhetorical question. So Jewish, right? So he says, "My whole life I've been wondering, when will come the time to be able to literally..." Oh, because in the first paragraph of Shema it says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart, b'chol nafshecha, with all your soul, and with all your might." With all your soul means, according to the understanding of the rabbinic understanding of it, with all your soul means even to the point that they take your soul. In other words, even if it costs you your life, still love God. So he said, "I've been saying the Shema all these years, thinking about, you know, will I ever have the chance to really practice what I preach? Now that I have, now that it's happening, I shouldn't be saying the Shema." So that's why I'm saying the Shema. This represents, this comes from a love of God that's not about what I get out of it, but it's about the pure connection. So that's how we ended chapter 2, by talking about these two levels of love. In chapter 3, we spoke about the challenges to realizing this deeper dimension of love. And what we said was that in times of exile, in other words, when we don't have a holy temple in Jerusalem, and we don't have all of the wonderful spiritual light that abounds around us, like we did back in the times of King David and King Solomon, back in what we might call the Jewish heyday, when everything was amazing, times of Moses, times of the Exodus, we don't see these things today. So we don't have that same type of godly light that's shining on us. It's a little bit harder. We don't see God. We see other stuff. We see traffic, right? We see, we see war. We see suffering in the world. We don't see the beauty, unfortunately. We don't always see the beauty. So in a time of exile, which again, exile means that really the mystical, Kabbalistic definition of exile is when things aren't right. You know, when things are right, that's a modality of redemption. In other words, that's when you're free to just be and truth is clear and you just see things for what they really are. That's geula, that's redemption. Exile means things aren't right. Whatever that means, you know, on an individual, things just aren't right. It's not, I'm not seeing what I should be seeing, I'm not aware of what I should be aware of, or I put priorities here when they should be there, whatever it is. So exile means just things are a bit topsy-turvy. Like we said, sleep in chapter 3. Sleep is when, instead of having the hierarchy of the mind, the heart, and, you know, in a sense, the feet, when you have, you know, the ideas, the feelings, and the action, everything's mixed up. So instead of doing what I'm excited about based on what's right, I'm doing what I'm excited about based on instinct, like an animal, and like a behemoth, that like an animal that walks on all fours, that doesn't have that type of human hierarchy. And like when we sleep, we're also flat, and everything is equal. The head, the heart, and the limbs are all equal. So galut, exile, is a time when things are mixed up. Things are just aren't right, aren't the way they should be. So in a time of exile, he said in chapter 3, it's very difficult to have the deep expression of soul and that love for God, let alone a very basic love of God. In other words, we're all lacking in times of exile a very basic appreciation and love for God, let alone the deeper, powerful connection that we have to give up everything, to surrender it all for God. So we're in a bit of a difficult situation. So we're stuck. So how do we advance? He said toward the end of chapter 3, he said that one method of bringing out the deep connection that the soul has is by... So he gave the example of wood. He said, if wood doesn't catch on fire, what do? Chop it up. Splinter it, get into smaller pieces. The same thing is true with the human being and with the soul. If a soul is not catching on fire, break it down. What does it mean to break it down or to chop it up? What it means is to think about all of the things that are not going as they should. In other words, to be what's called in Aramaic. Again, this is, a lot of Kabbalah is from Zohar, and Zohar was written in the Aramaic, so a lot of these phrases are Aramaic. It's called Mar de Chushbana, which means a master of accounts, which means introspective, but more than introspective, taking personal stock of where I am and what I've done and what I need to be doing, etc. And a person may come to the conclusion after taking such an account that their life is not exactly where it should be. In other words, a person can come to the conclusion that where they are and where they need to be, where they are and where they'd like to be, is not exactly the same place. And there's a lot of things that are getting in the way. So getting back to my example of the water and the dam, so now you realize that there's a lot of stuff in the way. That itself can increase the pressure and the vitality of the stream of the water, and in this case of the soul. When a person recognizes the challenges that they have in their divine relationship and the distance that they have to God, that itself can bring out a greater desire to connect. So to give you an example, person has a close relationship with somebody and then kind of neglects it for a little while to the point that they hurt the other person. So when you recognize, when you think deeply about how you've been neglectful and how you've been not attentive and how the other one has been hurt because of it, you might feel really terrible, but that itself can spur you to recommit to the relationship with a greater intensity. So it's almost like the opposite, the challenge to whatever it is, can bring out the best of that. The same thing again with the soul. The challenges to the soulful expression can bring out a greater depth of the soul. So, in very simple language, it's the lack of connection with God that can bring out the greatest, deepest connection with God. It's being in a space. It's being in the, as in using King David's language, it's being in the parched desert of spirituality that can evoke the greatest thirst for spirituality. If I'm in a place that has water, I might not be thirsty, even if I don't drink from it. If I'm a place that has water, I know I have a drink over there, I'm not desperate. But if I'm in a place that does not have water, suddenly I'll have this fierce desire for water. If and when a person realizes that they are in a spiritual, in a sense, I don't want to be over dramatic, but in a spiritual wasteland, spiritual desert, bereft of the living waters of God, that itself can evoke a powerful thirst. And in the language of our text, that brings out not just a basic love and thirst for God, but on the deeper level, level two, which is about totally surrendering oneself to God and to God's oneness. Make sense? Sort of? Okay. Now, this takes us to where we're up to, which is the last paragraph of chapter 3 before we get to chapter 4. So, it's page 78.
Can I just question?
Yes.
When King David said that, is that in Psalms?
Yes.
Is that actually in
Yes. He said, Sam alecha nafshi, kam alecha basari. My soul thirsts for you, he says. Be'eretz tzia va'ayef b'limayim, in a land that's parched and thirsty without water. Yeah, thank you. What is it, 63?
63.
63. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, so my soul thirsts in a land parched without water. And Kabbalah says, what's the connection? Why does he have to say that my soul thirsts for you in a land that's parched without water? Why does he say my soul thirsts for you? Why does he give the second half of that sentence? So Kabbalah explains that why is he thirsty to such an extent that he'll move mountains to get what he wants spiritually? It's because he's in the desert. It's because he's parched. In a place that's bereft of water. That's why he is so... That in itself increases the thirst. So, again, it's the lack that brings the desire. It's not having that brings out the full force. It's the dam that brings out the force of the water. It's the... I don't want to mess up the medical example. What would cause the blood pressure? Obstruction?
Plaque formation, cholesterol plaque.
Got it. Okay. So it's the obstruction that builds the pressure in a negative sense, right? Hopefully this does not happen whatever. Okay. Good. Good, good, good.
Maybe like if you're somewhere, there's only one Jewish community. I don't know, like in the middle of where the last Chabad move.
Somewhere,
Chicago, and sometimes just...
Yeah, wherever you go, there's something. Yeah.
And you just don't participate. There's only one Jewish community that's trying to build, and...
You feel very Jewy over there. Yeah.
And
it's true. It's true. I see it in... I don't know if you can... Yeah, they say that there was a town that had, 10 men, and they always had a minion. And then on the 11th, the guy moved into town. They never had a minion after that. So it's almost like, when there's the pressure, so you respond. Once there's no pressure, you don't need me. You have 10 more besides for me. I'm number 11, don't count me. Then no one shows up, right? No one. It's just the way it is. But that's not exactly your point, but I like what your point. You're in a community that has tons of Jewish stuff, whatever. But when you go, if you're working, your work takes you to a place, and there's only one, whatever, there's only one synagogue, one center, so suddenly you feel like there's so much, outside stuff, you want to really express, the Jewiness. Yeah.
Just a really quick story. My daughter, when she was in high school, she considered herself an agnostic Buddhist. And it was so odd that it was 9/11, and she was in a chorus, and they were drawn together. The chorus, it was a called assembly, and the chorus sang and so forth. And of course, parents and students all came.
This is on 9/11.
This would have been like the next day.
Oh, okay, then I got it.
So it would have been, because everybody's in shock, right? And it was during the moment that you would think 9/11 would be a reason to not believe in God. And remember, right. She's an agnostic Buddhist at this point. And she said as she was standing up there singing during this, horrific time, that is when she experienced God and gained a belief in God.
Interesting.
In the lowest of lows. I mean,
right.
Why then? Then you'd be saying, you'd think someone would say,
where's God? How could God allow this to happen? Yeah.
But isn't it
very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's in the place of lack or absence or challenge that sometimes the greatest force comes out. So this leads us into the last paragraph on 78 at the top, where he says that he basically contrasts a straightforward approach to this approach, which is not at all straightforward. Again, the straightforward approach, you want to add more water? Add more water. You want to increase the water flow? Channel, throw more water into there. You'll get more force of water. A backwards way of going about it is to put a rock in the way and then build a force of water. That's it's a backwards way. But sometimes that's what you need to get it going. 78. Ordinarily, He says, divine service begins with the revealed faculties, and only then does one reach the level of ru'uta deliba, a revelation of the simple desire of the soul. In other words, what he's saying here in simple language is, typically, you start off basic level, you do what you need to do because it makes sense, and then you advance more and more in your divine connection, divine commitment, until you reach a place where you're so committed to God that you're ready to give up, to totally surrender to God. That's a straightforward way where you're building up the power of your soul and the extent of your connection until it reaches this depth. During the time of exile, however, he says, when this order is impossible to follow, because why is it impossible to follow? Because it's exile. Exile, by definition, means things aren't running the way they should be. Things aren't as they ought to. So during the time of exile, however, when this order is impossible to follow, one must, quote, scale the wall. And scale the wall, I don't know why there's no footnote here. Scale the wall comes from Samuel, not 109, footnote 109 Samuel, a different verse in Samuel. Ledalek shor. It means you gotta storm the wall and first reveal the simple desire of the soul through repentance, which then brings about the revelation of the faculties. And what this means, again, is in a time when you're not going to be able to get to this deeper level through straightforward means, so then you have to, as he says, scale the wall. You have to just jump over by repentance. Repentance is not the right word here. It's tshuva, teshuva. I wrote the introduction into the translation. So tshuva means not necessarily repentance, but it means return. And in this case, it literally means return. In this case, what it means is when a person recognizes where they are and they want to return back to where they ought to be, that's the force. Remember, when a person is in the desert, and they're parched, not only because they're thirsty, but because they're in a desert, their fiercest desire is to return to settled land that has water. In other words, what is the tshuva? Teshuva means not repentance. Ooh, I did a sin, I have to fix this. It's not only about that. It's the wrong energy. Tshuva means I realize that I'm in a place that I shouldn't be, a place that's not who I really am inside. This is not my place, and I have a fierce desire to get to a better place. It's like when you do something wrong and you say to some, you hurt somebody, God forbid, and then you tell them later, I'm sorry, I don't know what came over me, I don't know how I did that, or I don't know, or that wasn't me. So, that wasn't me. Well, it was you. I mean, it wasn't me. It definitely was you. You pretty much looked the same as you did then, so it was you. No, but it wasn't me. It wasn't the true me. It wasn't the real me. I would, in a non-exile, in a non-upside-down state, I would have never done that. Now I did that, and I'm owning up to it. But I want you to know that that's not who I really am. So tshuva is basically the acknowledgement that where I am is not who I am. It's not where I really ought to be, and I want to get back to that better place. And that creates the sense of displacement where I'm here instead of here, and I need to be here, not here. I'm in a desert. That's not okay. That creates a vitality, an energy, and a sense of frenetic energy, and a passion to get back to that place. And that opens up. There's nothing that opens up the soul like a broken heart. That can open up the soul and reveal the depth of the soul's connection, which is this pure connection to God that defies all rationale and all logical reasoning. Make sense? Okay, that's chapter 3. Chapter 4, let's get into this. Now, what he does here is he says that based on everything that we've discussed, and there's a reason why I wanted to do a longer introduction before we got to chapter 4, not just knock out the paragraph which we were left with. It's because chapter 4 really picks up on all of the themes that I just reviewed, that we just went over. And it's very important. What he's about to say is there's two definitions, or there's two ways to refer to the human being in the mystical concept. You can refer to the human being as a human being, and you can refer to the human being as not a human being. There's a human dimension and a non-human dimension. So in the email, I was struggling, should I focus on the forehead or should I focus on the non-human human? I originally wrote the email as the non-human human, And then I changed it to the forehead because I thought, you know, non-human, human, I don't know, whatever. It's all the same, and you'll see what I mean. So there's the human element of the person and the non-human element of the person. What does that mean? Human, so here's the brief overview. Human means normal, rational, logical, methodical, step-by-step. Non-human means not subhuman, not negative, non-human, like zombie. No, it's not non-human in a negative way. Non-human in a transcendent way. Not limited to the typical human constructs. So for those of you that were with us at the beginning of this book, one of the first things that we covered, and it's been a few months, one of the big themes that we covered at the beginning was trying to define the human being. And if you remember, there was this big debate between the Kabbalists and the philosophers, what is a human being? What is the essence of a human being? If you recall, the philosophers, Jewish philosophers, they maintain, and these are philosophers that go back 1,000 years or whatever, like ancient Jewish writings, but written by Jewish philosophers. They write that what is at the core of the human being? Seichel, intelligence, chachma, wisdom. It's the mind that is the height of the human achievement, human capacity, human superiority. It's wisdom that defines the human being. The Kabbalists say, wisdom, that's a power that we have. That's not the extent of who we are. We're much more than just intelligent beings. So the philosopher, so what's the more? We're about to get there in a second. So again, the philosophers say that the greatest measure of a person is their intelligence. The mystics say there's another measure by which a person can be measured. And again, these two dimensions parallel human and non-human. Human is, as we'll see soon, wisdom, intelligence, chachma, seichel. Intelligent being is chachma, it is human. And then the non-human dimension is the super rational, not limited by binary logic dimension of the human being. So it is the human capacity, but it's not human the way we typically refer to it as. So again, this is an overview. Let's jump in now to the text. The text is incredible. It's very rich in content and in discussion. So here we go. Chapter 4, Transcendental Man. This simple desire, and what does it mean, this simple desire? The simple desire to completely lose oneself, dissolve within the totality, within the essence of God's reality, which is, he said before, is at the core of our souls. Each and every one of us has a soul, and at the core of that soul is a desire to completely connect with God. Like the fire that we said, always the flame always wants to flicker out, always wants to leave the wick and jump away, but the wick holds it, schleps it down until it's burnt up, and then it can, or the fuel is burnt up, and then it can go where it wants to go. So that's within each of us. He says, this simple desire is the level of, quote, he is not a man within the human. In other words, it's the non-human human. It's a non-human level of reality. To explain, man's unique quality is his power of speech. It's known that and we'll get to this soon, four letters of God's name. Put it out here. Meantime, I'm going to hold these up a little bit in a few minutes for a certain purpose here. Okay, so he says that, so there's four kingdoms of existence. There's inanimate objects, vegetation, animals, and the human being. In Jewish language, the human being is called the medaber, the speaker, the articulate one. So he says like this, to explain. Second paragraph, chapter 4. Man's unique quality is his power of speech, corresponding to the level of chachma, which is wisdom. So he says here, there's a correlation between speech and wisdom. It's intelligence that allows a creature to speak and to communicate. So that which does not have intelligence does not have the wisdom, so to speak, to communicate. Now, it would be interesting to look at modern research, modern science on the brain and on speech and how that correlates. But we know that when certain areas of the brain are damaged, it can affect the speech, right? If somebody, God forbid, has a stroke affects certain parts of the brain, and that can affect the capacity to speak. So, again, that's just one example. You know, I'm sure there's many. But you should know, I just want to take a half a step back. Whenever you see, like, medical ideas, which I think this is, when I say medical, biological ideas in Kabbalah. So here it says, you know, that speech corresponds to the level of chachma, which is wisdom. So, again, whether I understand the medicine, the medical behind it, or whether I don't, or whether even medicine understands it, here's one thing you have to know. If it's in Torah, it's got to be true. I'll give you one example. Last week, University of Edinburgh? Is that it? Okay. Edinburgh came out with a study that said that olive oil is good for the brain. Anybody see this? Olive oil is good for the brain. That's what it says. It says olive oil has something, whatever, it has something that works well with the brain, and it makes the brain healthier, and specifically the study came out to say, one of the things that it said is that it increases memory and retention, etc. Well, wouldn't you know it? The Talmud talks about this. 2,000 years ago, the Talmud says olives reduce memory. Olive oil increases memory. The Talmud says if you want to retain your studies, eat olive oil. That's what it says. So, do we need the University of Edinburgh to corroborate? We don't. But now, my olive oil capsule business called Memory Tabs, that will increase based... I'm sure I don't have that. Although someone, please feel free to jump into that market. Will increase memory 200%. The Talmud talks about it. It's a Jewish concept. In fact, Kabbalah says that there's a correlation between olive oil and wisdom, and it's something that we've talked about before in various texts that we've studied, the idea of whatever, that chachma, wisdom, has a correlation to olive oil. But that's just... The point is that... Whether science knows about it yet or will find out soon, one thing is for sure. If it's in the books, we know it's true. There's another story happened a few hundred years ago where a study came out. It was one of the mystics, one of the Rebbe's sons, told his father excitedly, and he was a young boy, that they came out with a new study that says that certain part of the brain controls... memory, and a certain part of the brain controls, one is memory and one is deep thought. So when you're trying to figure out something, it's one part of the brain. When you're trying to recall something, it's a different part of the brain. And they mapped it out within the brain or something, whatever. And so the rabbi says to his son, he says, very nice. He goes over to the bookshelf. He pulls out a discourse. This is one of the rabbis. I think it was... the fifth Rebbe to his son, or maybe the fourth Rebbe to his son, whatever. He pulled out a discourse, a mystical text from his grandfather, and he said, look, Zaidi wrote about this before. It's in the mystical texts. He says, that's why when you want to recall something, you look up. You want to remember something. There's typically a looking up, because somehow that triggers one part of the brain. And when I have deep contemplative thought, think about the deep thinking, right? Isn't the dude with the, right? So deep thought is down, and memory is, wait a second, where did I see? I don't know that anyone actually does that, but...
thinking about that.
Right, like that, like trying to remember if you do that. But if you want to remember if you do that, look up. Anyway, now for sure you'll do it, so then it'll prove itself. It is. I think it's true. I think when you want to deeply contemplate something, figure something out, I think, to me, it feels true. Listen, I know it's true because it's in the books. But again, there was something with the science that came out that said, this is part, whatever it is. The point is, it's all in Torah. So getting back over here. Speech, he says, corresponds to the level of chachma. By the way, that's why it says that babies don't speak until a certain time. Babies speak when their mind, when their brain reaches a certain level of development. The Talmud says that, and the Talmud is not mystical necessarily, although there's a lot of deep mystical secrets hidden within the stories and the, you know, the legal text of the Talmud. The Talmud says a child does not call Abba father or Ima mother. A child doesn't speak, doesn't verbally articulate calling his or her parents until they've tasted Tam Daga, until they've tasted the taste of grain. That's what it says in the Talmud. I'm sure Gerber would love that little thing. Buy our grains, you know, baby food, it's going to help your kids speak. But there's a truth to this, that there's a certain type of development that needs to happen, which is connected, and food has a plays a role. Certain types of food plays a role, and certain types of food play a role in the development of the human being, of the body, of the physiology, as well as the brain. And at a certain point of development, that's when a child can begin to speak. You know, they tell a humorous story of a kid that just wasn't speaking, getting older and older, wasn't speaking. And they, one expert, another expert, wouldn't speak. Finally, one day, At the dinner table, the kid speaks. He says, "The soup is too cold." The soup is too cold. First word. They say to him, "What's going on?" They're jumping for joy. He's speaking. Wow, why is this the first time you're speaking? It sounds like you know how to speak. Why don't you speak? He's like, "Everything's been good until now. It's the first time something's not good. The soup is cold. I'm speaking up." But jokes aside, you know, he says, Medaber, the human being, being called a speaker is connected to the intelligence, to the chachma that is uniquely human. Now, I know animals can also communicate, but not on the same level of creative language. The truth is, I don't know this firsthand, but I know dolphins, right? Dolphins communicate. Do dolphins write poetry? Not write. Do dolphins speak? Do they have? Not that I know of. So I'm not saying they don't. Are there poetry slams, like spoken, like whatever, poetry in the ocean? It would be very cool if there was.
Maybe
to them. Right. So that's what I'm saying. I don't know, but what I do know is, what it says here again, is that there is a speech, a level of speech that is unique to man. It says man's unique quality is his power of speech. That means unique to the other forms of life. And it says it's connected to the unique, I'm throwing in the unique, level of chachma, of wisdom that he has. Okay, let's get back. Eitz Chaim, back inside. Eitz Chaim, which is a Kabbalistic text written by the student of the Arizal, Eitz Chaim explains that the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human kingdoms correspond to the four letters of the name Havaya. Havaya is God's name, the tetragrammaton, God's four-letter name, the one that we don't pronounce as it's written, which is why the Kabbalists switch the order of the letters instead of Yud, then He, then Vav, then He, which is the name the way it's written. They move it around so that you can pronounce it. They go like this, Havaya, like that. So it's still the same letters, but it's switched so that we can at least pronounce it instead of saying the name that we can't pronounce, because that's awkward, right? Like when Prince changed his name to the symbol, it was always like, how do you call him? Verbally, it's like the artist formerly known as Prince. Okay, that's awkward. So the Kabbalists move it around so that you can, I'm sorry that it's two-dimensional, so the Kabbalists move it around so that you can get this, which is Havaya, but the point is it's still the four letters of God's name. And it says in Kabbalah, in Eitz Chaim, Yud Kei Vav Kei, I want to get the right order, that these four letters, in the right order, correspond to the human, animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms, starting from the last. So the last hay of God's name corresponds to the mineral kingdom, which I referred to before as the inanimate. It's the part of life, part of this world that doesn't move. At least we don't see it move. Everything moves, right? But it's the part that doesn't move, doesn't grow, just kind of sits still and without any quote-unquote animation. Inanimate, it doesn't move. That's the hay. The hay is, in Kabbalah, the hay is connected to the sphera, to the energy of Malchut. Malchut is the last of the 10 sphera, the 10 energies of creation. And Malchut is connected with the earth. Malchut produces growth, just like the earth produces growth. It's interesting, isn't it, that the lowest The earth, the ground, the lowest, everyone steps on it. Talk about a shmata. You know what a shmata is? Like a rag that everyone steps on. Oh, yeah, I don't want to be a shmata, have people walk all over me. Well, the earth is literally that. Everyone walks all over the earth. It's the lowest, paradoxically, but not paradoxically, that produces the growth. It's like what produces life and growth and everything? It's the stuff that's, you know, step on it. It's, right? That's what has this incredible vitality. You think it's dead? You think it's empty? Put a seed in there. Watch. Whoosh. Right? I mean, Cece, you garden and what?
Tomatoes coming out beautifully.
From the ground. You ever think about this? What's going on with that? How does the ground do that? The ground is, you think it's dead, it's silent, it's domain, it's silent, it's inanimate, it doesn't do anything. Oh, it doesn't do anything.
Well, I have really good soil, too.
Right.
You have to have good soil.
You got to have good soil.
But, of course, well, weeds will grow in clay. So.
Right.
And there's some good weeds to eat.
Kabbalah has a big discussion. Is it the seed that grows, or is it the earth? Wait, hold on. Kabbalah's conclusion is, listen to this. Again, I don't know how this works botanically. It says that the seed only, not only, the seed stirs the earth's innate power of growth, which ultimately produces the growth. You need the seed. But the question is it, and I'm not saying I'm not saying that the seed doesn't turn into the thing, into whatever it is that's growing. But it's almost like Kabbalah says, it's really the earth that's producing the growth. The seed just gets the earth going. The seed is like the catalyst to get the earth producing.
Like sugar in the spoon.
Explain.
It's like, well, if you put sugar in tea,
yeah,
the sugar that's making it sweet, or does it tell you how many times to stir?
Right. Okay. Right. Exactly. Right. So, but in that case, you know, who knows the sugar. But I think, but Kabbalah's conclusion, I believe, is that it's really the earth. It's really the earth. The seed on its own wouldn't do anything. The power of a seed, of a hard seed, to turn into something that's alive and growing is all in the earth. It's almost like, and again, the same parallel is with human procreation, etc. So where is the power of birth? In the father or the mother? The answer is in the mother, not in the father. So, again, do you need... Yes, of course you need... But the real koach, the real power is in the earth, is in, again, the mother and the womb, etc. And in our case, so, again, malchut, so the last hey, it's the lowest, you think. It's the lowest, it's the most basic. Bottom line is, that has the greatest growth. Now, from the earth, what grows out? What grows from the earth? Grass and flowers and plants and trees. Well, look at the second to last letter. It's the vav. And I picked a font that's like I'm not happy with. Whatever. The vav is typically a straight line, like a tree, right? It's the growth. Vav is also the vav of God's name, the third letter of God's name, also corresponds not to malchut, but to the six emotive divine energies. Chesed, gevura, Teferet, love, severity, compassion, ambition, humility, communicativeness. So it's the emotional powers of the ten sefirot, six of the emotional powers. Well, that's also connected to vegetation. Why? Because emotion has a lot of growth to it. Emotion is volatile. Emotion starts off small, and then you begin feeling something, and it gets very big, very grand. It can grow very tall, like a tree, like vegetation that, see, animals move laterally, humans move laterally, but trees, they get very big. Emotions are like that. Emotions also get very big, can get very big. And if it's an emotion, if it's a real emotion, it's going to get very big. That's just the way it is. So vav, again, corresponds to the tree. So here you have the earth, which is malchut, which is the growth, the lowest but the highest, really. Then you have the emotions, vegetation. Then hey, this corresponds to bina. Bina is understanding, but also intuition. It also is like an intuitive understanding. It's not only, typically we talk about bina as being what's the word I was looking for? Not academic analysis, but maybe also, analytical understanding. That's what I was looking for. It's not only analytical understanding, it's also intuitive understanding, where something kind of, like, it makes sense, this kind of a certain perception of it. This is connected to the animal kingdom. Animals have a lot of intuition. And so animals know where to go, where to hunt. They sense, they understand. Animals have a lot of being, have a lot of understanding. That's how they survive, and that's how they take care of their young and everything. It's all, they have a certain understanding that is more instinctual than creative. And then you have the Yod, the first letter of God's name, which is, again, the highest. So the hierarchy would be kind of like this. Yod, well, it's not going to work. Yod. Hey, and then I'm out of hands. Okay, whatever. You get the picture, right? And then Vav, and then Hey at the bottom. I feel like this is like a cheerleading thing. Oh, and everyone falls. Okay, so Malchut, which is the earth. Zah, the six emotions. Vegetation. Hey, Bina, intuitive understanding. Animal kingdom. Yud, Chachma, wisdom. Speech. As we said before, this is the Yud. Yud is Chachma. It's the smallest letter. It's the most pristine, in a sense. It's the simplest letter. It's just like a dot, almost. Here, it's more than a dot because, you know, it's a font and whatever. But Yud really could be just a dot. A Vav is also pretty simple, but you take the dot and you move it down. Yud, theoretically, could be the single point. It's the smallest. It's the most pristine. It's the seminal point of intelligence, of wisdom, and it is what helps the quality of speech, and it's a uniquely human quality, is Chachma. Here we go. Let's continue inside. Three lines from the bottom, 78, and he says what we just said. The human kingdom corresponds to the first Yod, Chachma. There you go. So, if we talked about what is a human being, who is a human being? A human being is not just growth, is not just earthly growth, it's not just vegetation, it's not just animal intuition, but it has, the human being has chachma, has wisdom, has real wisdom, creative wisdom, and speech, etc. All of this is the human level of human. Remember, we're going to talk about human and not a man. But not man doesn't mean gender, right? It means not human. So there's human and not human. This is human. Yud, chachma. Second to last line. Ratzon will, however, transcends Chachma and is the title? I don't know what that is. A title atop the Yud. So what that means, Kotso Shel Yud. So again, the font here is not really wonderful. Because this is like, you know, computer font. The way a Yud is really drawn is, you know what, can I borrow a pen for a second? I'm going to draw Yud. It's not going to be very thick, so, because, you know, it's just a pen. Okay, this is a Yud. Now, it's a terrible Yud, but it's kind of a Yud. You see that? It looks like a resh almost. But bottom line is, there's a little thing. If I had a thicker, like, more calligraphy thing, it would be drawn out more like this, right, with that curve, but there's a slight curve to it. But the top, you take the quill, and the first thing is you create a point, and then you come down to make the rest of the Yud. Again, Yud is theoretically a dot, but the way it's written in the Torah, it's a little bit more form than that, but it always starts with the coats, with the point of the Yud. Which one, this one? It does, actually. Huh. Interesting. So he says like this. Kabbalah says the Yud is Chachma. But the point at the top of the Yud is Ratzon, is desire, will. Which desire and will refer to Ru'uta Deliba. Remember the fierce desire of the soul to connect to God in a way that's irrational? I want to just completely surrender myself to God. That is hinted by the point of the Yud that's above the Yud itself. 80. Here we go. Now we're going to bring all the themes together, hopefully, and then advance it. This is, top of page 80, this is the level of, quote, he is not a man. This is the superhuman level of the human being. the level of the human being as a normal human being is an intelligent creature that can speak. Intelligent, understands what life is, can articulate it, and wants more of it. A desire that a person has to surrender oneself and to become subsumed within the divine reality is not human, it's not normal. And yet we have that desire within our soul. The core of our soul wants that. Where does that come from? That's a non-human dimension of the human being. It's not normal, it's not human, but we have it. It's not the yud of the human being, it's the dot on, it's the point on top of the yud. So that's what he says. This is the level of he is not a man. And it's the two levels alluded to in the verse in Genesis, let us make man in our image and in our form. And it's interesting, you could study that verse 1,000 times. This is the verse that tells us that we are created in God's image. And typically we say that we're created in God's image. When Torah says image and form, it says two different things. It says, Nasa Adam, let us make man. Bitzalmenu kidmusenu. No one ever quotes the second one. We always say God created a human being in his image. Well, there's image and there's form. And it's, I think, very telling that we only focus on image based on the explanation that's about to come in this paragraph. Image is a reference to the 10 faculties, the 10 human powers, which stem from the 10 sfirot, the 10 mystical powers, the first of which is chachma, which is wisdom. Form, so that's what it means. God created us in his image. We have all the 10 powers, starting with wisdom. We're intelligent creatures, the yod, chachma, etc. Form, however, refers to the ru'uta deliba, that fierce desire of the soul to connect with one and lose its own identity, that which the soul possesses from the Ein Sof, from the infinite, beyond Chachma, as explained in the verse, Ve'ata hare mesmatcha. He cites another discourse that explains that. Okay, here's the point. When the Torah says that God created us in his image and in his form, there's two things. In his image means human. In his form means we're not human. In his image means that we have 10 powers, the human powers, starting with Chachman, going down, intellectual capacity, emotional capacity, etc. Kidmusenu, God created us in his form, means he created us with the capacity to lose ourselves and become one with him. In other words, in a way that transcends wisdom and seichel, in a way that transcends any rational or logical consideration. Make sense?
Yes. You know, it reminds me yesterday when we were talking at Kiddush, we were talking about this idea of the collective, that we're all part of a God's soul. You know, when we're talking about
But
at the same time,
there's the individuality.
Right. So,
so what Karen's referencing is this notion that we all share one soul in different bodies. So we're all one. At the same time, we're all individuals. So there's this duality. It's almost like this, right? So the lower level in God's image means our individuality, our different blend of these 10 herbs and spices, the 10 powers of the soul. Everyone has a little more chachma, a little more bina, a little more chesed, a little more gvura, a little bit kind, a little bit more disciplinarian, a little bit more compassionate, more ambitious, more humble. Everyone's got their own unique personality. That's a unique blend to who they are as distinct from someone else. And then you have this higher level, which is this what's the word? I want to say disillusionment, but that's a wrong, I don't think that's the wrong, where you want to dissolve, this desire to just totally dissolve within the divine essence, which would be the same for everybody. In other words, it's not like, I want to dissolve first. No, slow it down. That's not dissolving then. If you want to surrender, it's not like there's an order or hierarchy to the surrender. Like, I surrender better than you. That, wait a second, then you didn't surrender. You're still maintaining your ego there. So surrender would be the higher level where there is a oneness, in a sense, amongst everybody, because it's that core connection, that oneness with God.
It's when all of us, maybe this, in my mind, this is the image I get, it's when all of us are shining our light, right? And then all that light is, it's like the candle where, you know, the two candles
Right, you're putting the different wicks together to make one torch. Yeah, yeah. So here you have a beautiful explanation of why the Torah uses two phrases. And you can, again, like I said before, you can study it 1,000 times and think the Torah is being poetic. It's saying God, you know, let us, who's us, where, God and the angels, whatever, let us make man in our image, in our form. Yeah, basically means in his image. Basically. But specifically, it means two different things. Basically, generally speaking, yeah, we're creating God's image. But very specifically, Kabbalah says, no, two things. We have a human dimension to the human being, and then there is a superhuman level, and that is our perfect connection with God that transcends any rational consideration, and that is image. Let's continue. Similarly, in Idra, the Idra Rabbah, which is another mystical text, the Idra Rabbah comments on the verse, and God formed man. This comes from Genesis 2:7. The first verse, let us make man in our image and in our form, is Genesis 1:26. This is now Genesis 2:7. It says, and God formed man. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim. God, well, it's Hashem Elokim. God. Again, two names of God, okay? Formed man. Vayitzer has two yuds. And you could see it in the English itself. You have the Hebrew word there. Usually there's not Hebrew in the English, but it's very specific to this interpretation. You have two yuds. One of them is unnecessary. You don't need two yuds for vayitzer. In Hebrew, you can write it with one yud and you'll be fine. What's the double yud? What, like, you getting paid by the letter here? The typesetter? Like, what's going on? The scribe's like, let me throw an extra yud in here. What's going on? So... Ah, so the Idra Rabbah explains that there are two yuds in the word vayitzer. One yud alludes to chachma, and the other yud alludes to keter, which is the level of desire, the dimension where he's not a man. In other words, the same duality of the human being. It's all part of the human being. One is a human level, and one is a level even greater than the human being within the human being. It's still within the human being. It's not like it's not human, so we don't have it. We do have it. That's the point. But we have a level. We have a dimension, We have an aspect to our existence that's rational. We consider things. We analyze them. They make sense. We'll do it. That's one dimension that we operate on. And then there's another level. Another level where we're willing to do whatever it takes to discover truth. We're willing to give up all of our other stuff to find something, to connect with something higher than ourselves. That's not normal. We have it. It's not human in this... It's not human. It's human. We have it. But it's the level that's called not a man. The Idra Rabbah explains, now let's get to the forehead. Oh, this is great. So again, we have the duality encoded secretly within the narrative of creation in Genesis. You could study the story of Genesis and you see human beings created, cool, in the image of God, nice. But wait a second. There's a duality in his form. In his image, in his form. Two things. Vayitzer, God formed. Again, two yuds. There's two things. There's two dimensions of the human being. A lower and a higher dimension. And now he says, this is also explains the construct of the face. The human face has two levels to it. Look at the face before we jump into the text. You have the forehead. You have, it's not exactly halfway. It's a little, I guess, the top third. But you have from the forehead up and then from the nose down. What we're about to say is, from the nose down is your face. From the forehead up is the transcendent level. In other words, everyone's the same on the level of forehead, right? Yes. There's a oneness and a sameness, a transcendence that the forehead bespeaks. And there's a particularism. There's your identity from basically here down, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, right? The individual features of the face are specifically you. That's human. That's the human level. The superhuman, the level that's not about you, but about something greater than you, that's the forehead, according to Kabbalah. It's unbelievable. This idea is powerful. So the duality within the human being is in the narrative of creation, and it's even within the human physiology, the biology of the face. Let's jump in. The Idra Rabbah explains... Again, this is an ancient mystical text, that the second higher yud is the dimension of the forehead. regarding which the verse states, no man has dwelt there. I love it. I love it. It says, no man has dwelt there. The forehead is no man's land. What does that mean? What, no one's living on your forehead? Obviously. What it means is the forehead is not, it's not you. It's not, he continues, for the forehead is beyond, oh, this is a big word. The forehead is beyond the physiognomy of man. In other words, of course the forehead is part of you, but it's also beyond you. He says, therefore, and this is reflected in Jewish law, look at this. Therefore, the testimony of a witness as to the identity of an alleged deceased married man is only valid when he testifies that he recognized the physiognomy, I don't know, that with the nose, since it is from there that the distinct features begin, two eyes, two ears, and two nostrils. So let me explain this. The law states, how do you know? God, I mean, this is a negative situation, but how do you know when a husband is deceased? You need to identify, say a husband is traveling or goes out to war, back in the day, right? And the wife is at home, the kids are at home, and the husband doesn't come back. And so somebody comes back from the battlefield saying, I saw your husband, he's dead. So he's deceased. So now she is a widow and she's now free to remarry, etc. And you know, I don't want to make it just about remarrying because there's a lot, right, mourning. But now you know that there's a finality there because someone has identified the body. The question the Jewish law addresses is, how do you identify the body? What constitutes an identification of the deceased? How do you ID? They didn't use dental records then. I mean, this is back in Talmudic times. So how do you...
DNA.
Right, and certainly not DNA. So how do you identify? So that it's an incredible idea. This comes from the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Talmud discusses it. So Jewish law says, a valid ID is the facial features, basically from the nose, eye, ears, like that... two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, basically from the nose down of the face, like from here down. If you just say, you know, I saw so and so, he's deceased, he's passed, he was killed, he died, and how do you know it was him? I recognize his forehead. It's not a valid ID. It's not a valid identification. You cannot identify somebody by the forehead.
Unless it was the guy with the almonds.
Okay, there's a story in, where is it from? Story in Chronicles or Kings, of a king, Chronicles, of a king who went into the temple to offer incense when he shouldn't have offered incense, and so he was punished with a cluster of almonds coming out of his head. So, right, if that was forehead, can't eat an almond without thinking about that. Okay, it's a gross, whatever, it is what it is. It's like a form of leprosy specifically that afflicted him. Anyway, bottom line is, if someone IDs the dude with the cluster of almonds from his forehead, then maybe it's not just a normal forehead, and maybe that counts. It's like, wait a second, is your husband the guy who had a cluster of almonds out of his forehead? Because I definitely saw that forehead. No, but typically the forehead is not a valid space of IDing because it's so blank. It's such a blank slate. In other words, of the human body, of the human being that is so distinct and unique, the forehead, I think also the kind of like the back of whatever, but the forehead, at least in this context, is the purest. It's the most non-individually specific part of, at least part of the head, face, etc. Okay, so what does that mean? Oh, let's continue. He keeps on explaining. The bottom paragraph 80. The forehead, however, is above these distinctions, i.e. of the nose, the mouth, the eyes, etc. The forehead is above these distinctions and relates to the level of desire about which the verse states, 82, that this is where, quote, no man has dwelt. Let's continue just very quickly because he just cites it. This is discussed in the Likutei Torah and explaining the verse to Ena Ra'ena. Okay. Let's continue. Thus, ruts and desire is a dimension beyond that of, quote, man. So here we have, again, reiterating the two dimensions of man. Again, man is not gender specific. It means the human being. The human being has two levels. the level of the human being that is human and the level that is superhuman. So there's a level that's human, i.e. rational, logical, emotional, etc. And then there is transcendent. I'm ready to surrender to something greater, even though it doesn't make sense, even though I might be scared, it doesn't matter, I'm willing to surrender. That's a level that's so lofty, so deep, we say it's not human. Of course it is human, because we have it, but it's not of the typical, it's not normal, it's not, it's the non-human dimension of the human. It's like the godly part of the human being, therefore he says it's transcending the human definition. One more paragraph. This is why, 82, this is why man, the human being, is called Adam, because he resembles the Supreme One. Oh, this is not going to work in English. Okay. It says in Kabbalah that what does the name Adam mean? We know that Adam was the name given to the first human being, who was comprised actually of both male and female before they were separated from each other. But anyway, Adam is the first human being. Why the name Adam? There are many, many deep hints and many messages contained in that word. One message, that's not our message, but one message is Adam is comprised of three letters. Aleph, which is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and then the letters Dalet Mem, which form the word Dam, which means blood. And so here you have a hint within the name Adam that there's Aleph, there's the one, there's the soul, that's part of one God, and Dam, and then the flesh and blood, that's the human dimension, that's the lower human dimension. So again, this duality even within the name Adam. But here he goes a different dimension. Adam, he says, and this is an old mystical teaching, is related to the word Adameh, which means similar to, or in the likeness of. And what does it mean that Adam is in the, who is Adam, Adameh? Who is man, Adameh, similar to? Adameh le'elyon, similar to the one on high, similar to God Almighty. But it says God, Elyon, the lofty one. So he says Elyon is the level, so in the translation here, it's supreme one. Okay, the supreme one, Elyon, refers specifically to the level of, quote, he is not a man. If so, how can man resemble the supreme one if he is defined by Chachma? This can only be because man also possesses a transcendent level where he is not a man, and this level resembles the Supreme One. It's a little bit of a question and answer, but we already know the answer before he asked the question. It's a kind of a rhetorical question, and that is like this. Adam is named so. One of the reasons why Adam is called Adam is because he resembles the Supreme One, the supernal being, God, on a transcendent level. But if a person is logical, person is, like the philosopher said, a person is wisdom and logic and rational. So how can you resemble God who's transcendent? Ah, because the human being also has a transcendent dimension, and in that way, the human being resembles a transcendent God. So again, the bottom line here is that there are two dimensions of the human being. One is logical and rational from the head down, and then the other one is from the head up. One is a logical, feeling, doing creature. That's the human nature, that's the human part of the human being. And then you have the supernatural or the superhuman part of the human being, which is referred to as the forehead, as the other yud, as the form, as Adameh, similar to the one above. And that is the part of the human being that's transcendent, that's beyond wisdom, beyond rationale, the part of us that can connect with God just because innately God is part of our reality, not for any rational reason. So here we have a nice look at the duality of the human being. And so what we're actually saying is that the philosophers did get it right. On the level of humanness, they got it right. But the philosophers missed the second dimension of the human being, which is not human. By the way, in case you're wondering, why are we so stuck on the phraseology of human versus not human? Why not just say human and divine, or human and, you know, transcendent? Why human and not human, not a man? It's because of the opening verse of our discourse, which talked about the high priest going into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. And it said, no man shall go into the Holy of Holies. And we're trying to figure out, how could no man go into the Holy of Holies if literally a man was going into the Holy of Holies? You can probably see the answer being formulated now. When the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, he was on the level of not a man, right? But now you understand why, hopefully this explains why he's using language of these two dimensions of the human being. The logical and the super rational is the human and the non-human, or the man and not the man. Again, this is going to come into play when we're explaining a verse that talks about no man being in the Holy of Holies when literally the high priest, a man, was there. Okay, so that's it for today. So what did we learn? In summary, we learned about, we reviewed this notion of how to unleash the essence of the soul, sometimes through the opposite, through unsoulful things. So things that push against the soul can bring out the raw power of the soul. We spoke, therefore, about the duality of the human experience and connecting with God, one on a rational level and one on a essential soul sheer force level. And then we explained that when you look at the story of man's creation and you look at how the human being is described in various places, whether it's halacha, forehead, nose, or whether it's linguistically two yuds instead of one yud, whatever, no matter where you look when it comes to the human being, you see these two dimensions, the logical, rational, human dimension, and the super logical, super rational, divine, non-human dimension. And all of this will help us understand other things as we get further into the text. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and coffee.